John Sitzer, in his book A Grace Disguised, says, "Catastrophic loss wrecks havoc, wrecks destruction like a massive flood. It is unrelenting, unforgiving, and uncontrollable, brutally erosive of body, mind, and spirit. Sometimes loss does its damage instantly as if it were a flood resulting from a broken dam that releases a great torrent of water, sweeping away everything in its path. Sometimes loss does its damage gradually as if it were a flood resulting from unceasing rain that causes rivers and lakes to swell until they spill over their banks, engulfing, saturating, and destroying whatever the water touches. In either case, catastrophic loss leaves the landscape of one's life forever changed." The picture there, the landing in the Hudson that happened a few years ago, changed those people's lives forever, especially the pilot, who actually is from Washington State here. Truth is, loss comes in all sorts of shapes and sizes and events and circumstances, and loss is a huge part of our life if you think about it. We remember 911. If you were in Mississippi after Katrina, there's at least one picture up there that you ought to recognize from Pascagoula, the boat that was done. That's a picture of me in 1969 in Vietnam and changed my life forever. The losses that occurred and the things I experienced in 1969 in Vietnam. The police officer that's there, does anybody know who that is? Ralph Painter. Changed our neighborhood, our region forever. Constantly and totally changed it. And of course, the thing that changed and created loss so great in our world in one sense was Jesus on the cross. And the loss that that created for the disciples and for his followers during that period of time. But again, loss comes in all shapes and sizes. And biblically, we can think of Adam and Eve who lost a son, Abel, when Cain killed his brother. Cain killed him. We can think about Job and Joseph, we're going to talk about in a little bit. And Daniel, who was minding his own business, was taken captive to Babylon, ended up in a lion's den, lost all sorts of freedom. Samson, who lost his eyesight, couldn't see anymore because of some things that occurred in his life. Hosea, God told him to marry a gal. She ran off and had an affair, or more than one affair, on him. And then God says, take her back. And so there's this huge loss kind of thing throughout the Bible. The nation of Israel was taken captive by Egypt. We remember that. And after that, they were taken captive by the Babylonians. And then later by the Romans. And so the nation of Israel has been in captivity many, many times over the history of life. And each loss causes something and creates, takes something away from. A week ago, Tuesday, I was asked to teach on a passage out of Luke 22, and it's where Judas sells out Jesus to the religious leaders, and then ultimately commits suicide. And it's because he'd lost hope, because he'd lost faith in God and how things were going to work out, and he was so disgruntled by it all that he ended up taking his own life. A little over a year ago, I had three-way heart bypass surgery. And 45 days later, our 20-year-old grandson, Kyle, drowned in Lake Cushman. Trust me when I say this. I've had plenty of time to think about loss in life the last few months. Plenty of time to try to assimilate what it means and why it happens and what it looks like and what do we do. And perhaps that's the biggest question I ask myself is, what do we do when loss comes? And especially as believers, what do we do? How do we get through this thing? Philippians 4:13 says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Well, the truth is we can't do all things. You can't run a two-minute mile. I don't care how much Jesus you got in you, you're not going to run a two-minute mile. You can't jump over the Grand Canyon. I don't know how many prayer meetings, you went to, how many times you and God have conversation, how much time you spend in the Bible. You can't jump over the Grand Canyon. And so really a better translation of that is not we can do all things through Christ, but we can endure all things through Christ who strengthens us. You see, that we can do. We can endure. We can get through losses through Christ who strengthens us. So that's a better way to, a better translation, actually, that verse. And Romans 8:28 says, all things come to good for those who love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. And so again, it's one of those verses, one of those promises that God gives us that, that in the midst of loss, there are good things that happened. And Patrick gave testimony of that a little bit ago. But let's take a few minutes and just look at loss and what it does to us. First thing I want us to understand is all people suffer loss. Everyone suffers loss. I could take the mic around the room and every one of you could give me an example of a time or a situation, a circumstance where you lost something, where it cost you something, and you something you cared about, something you loved, something you that meant something to you is no longer with you. Matthew 5:45 says it rains on the just and the unjust. The very meaning of life is that there's going to be change. Things are going to be different tomorrow than they are today. And part of that difference comes often when there's a great loss in our lives. And we all face it. Again, all of us. Nobody's exempt from it. We lose our youth to gain our adulthood. We lose security of home for independence of being out on our own. We lose a daughter to gain a son-in-law. Kevin and Nina just recently went through that. We lose the warmth of summer for fall and to winter and to spring and ultimately back to summer again. But there's another kind of loss that I want us to think about that's the kind that can be devastating and is irreversible. Things like the doctor tells you you've got irreversible cancer. Or because of some freak accident, you lose your leg, your arm. Or you go through a divorce after many, many years. Or you suffered physical or sexual abuse somewhere along the line in life, and as a result, you lost something in that process. Maybe you're a victim of chronic unemployment. No matter what you do, no matter how hard you try, you just can't seem to keep a job. My dad died with Alzheimer's. I watched his mental capacity slowly disintegrate. He lost his ability to function as a result of that. And ultimately, of course, death that comes. It creates what I used to call in the chaplaincy business a new normal. All of that change, all of those circumstances, all those situations create for us what I call a new normal. And I think that's a healthy way to look at it. The police shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, this last couple of weeks, that changed that town forever. Without taking sides on one side or the other, good or bad, because quite frankly, as some of the media said, none of us know what really happened. We need to be careful about judging that whole situation. But one thing I can tell you, that town has changed forever. The loss that they've occurred. The suicide of Robin Williams that happened a few days ago. That changed Hollywood forever. There's a loss that they've suffered and something that they think they're exempt from, and their money and their power and their influence can keep them from suffering those kinds of things. But the whole industry suffered a huge loss when Robin Williams committed suicide. The spouse dies and all of a sudden you're a widow or a widower. You're just getting ready for retirement and your boss comes to you and says, you know, I'm sorry, Steve, but things are just a little tough around here right now, and we're going to have to downsize, and you're fired. Hundreds of death calls I've been on as a chaplain over the years. I haven't got a clue how many deaths I've dealt with in my life. Hundreds and hundreds of them. Started way before I became a chaplain. And then the death that affected me probably the most tragically a year ago when Kyle died. The problem is, though, we tend to compare and try to quantify our losses and our suffering. And we talk about the number of deaths that we've had in our family or the length of a hospital stay or the severity of the hospital stay or how terrible the abuse was that we went through or how my family's more dysfunctional than your family and the details of a divorce and just to show how ugly and how bad it was for us and how we live a life full of bad luck, like Linus in the Charlie Brown cartoons. Oh, he's got this cloud hanging over his head. Loss is loss. Doesn't make a lick of difference, the circumstances. Because the truth is that no two losses are the same. In fact, I can tell you quite clearly, Kyle's death affected me differently than it affected Carmen. Same event, but the effects are different because the relationship's different. So what value is it that we ought to compare our losses? I don't think there's any value. Does it really matter whose loss is worse than the next person? I don't think so. No one knows the loss that I felt when I got the call that Kyle died. Wayne probably is the closest to it. He's the first person I called that night. And he came to my house and prayed with me and sat with me. But even Wayne doesn't know what it felt like any more than I know what your loss felt like or feels like. So can we agree right now that we're going to stop comparing our losses to see who's got the worst loss? And just accept the fact that all of us suffer loss. All of us go through those difficult circumstances that we think our world is crashing down and never going to come back good again. The operative question is not whose loss is worse. The operative question is, what can we learn from the loss? And how can we grow from the suffering? So the first thing I suggest to us is all of us suffer loss. The second thing I would suggest is it's always dark before the light. I don't often get up early enough to see the sunrise, but every once in a while I do. When we were in Hawaii last time, I got up every morning to see the sunrise because we're looking eastward. We're on the east side of the island, so I didn't get sunsets. I got sunrises. Be totally honest with you, I went back to bed afterwards, but I got up and looked at the sunrise. And think about this for a minute. What if it was never dark? Would there be a sunrise? No. In order for us to have a sunrise and to enjoy it and to wrap our arms around it, we have to have the darkness first. Can I suggest to us the same thing is true in the personal way of our losses in life? We have to choose to run from our loss or face it head on. And I will grant you, facing it head on is easier said than done. Again, I've had a lot of time to process and deal with loss this last year. But there are both positive and negative consequences to our choices. Philip Yancey wrote a book, Disappointment with God, and in the book he talks about the dark night of the soul. And in some losses, there is that point in time when it just is so dark, it's almost overbearing the darkness that seems to be around you. And I've been there, and I understand that. But still, the first step toward growth is always a step toward pain. The only way I can grow from Kyle's death experience is to step toward it, is to enter into that world of darkness, is to embrace that event and let God teach me and let God show me and let God mold me from that event the way that He wants to do it and not necessarily the way I want it to happen, but the way He wants it to happen. In Kyle's death, I knew what to do. I mean, for crying out loud, I'm a professional chaplain. I'm a trained, certified chaplain. I know what to do when somebody dies. But you know what? I didn't know what to do. It hurt so bad. And it seemed so dark in that moment that I didn't know what to do other than to call my friend. And I'm glad I did. But for weeks after that, I didn't know what to do. Listen, I'm a trained pastor, a chaplain. I've even been to seminary. I took Hebrew and Greek. And I didn't even know how to talk to God in those moments. It was so dark. I'm so glad the scriptures tell me that when I don't know what to pray, the Holy Spirit will pray for me. And I'm also glad that when my faith was weak and when I began to doubt and I began to question and I began to point a finger at God, that God didn't get upset with me. In fact, if anything, he drew closer to me in the midst of that. I can't explain it. I don't even understand it all. I'm just telling you, that's what happened. Then in the midst of the darkest of times of Kyle's death, God drew closer to me in the midst of it all. Even though I didn't necessarily want him to be around at times. I'm just being honest with you. There were times when I wanted God to take a hike. Because I was angry. I was hurting. And the last thing I wanted was somebody to give me some big religious diatribe about, well, if you'll just do this. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Romans 8, 26, 27, which says, when we don't know what to pray, the Holy Spirit will intercede for us. And again, I'm just trying to be honest with you. The darkness hasn't left me yet. I still have moments when I cry. I still have moments when I'm weak. I still have moments when I shake my fist at God. This coming Friday, we're going up to Gig Harbor to mark the one-year anniversary of Kyle's death. And I know that's going to be hard for me and for the rest of us. But I can't speak for anybody else. I can just speak for me. I know it's going to be hard. But one of the things we're going to do, we're going to light some of those floating candle things, you know, those air thing, you know what I'm talking about? We're going to put some light into the darkness. And I don't know about how anybody else will view that, but for me, that's symbolic of God bringing light into the darkness for me in the spiritual realm. I know that may be goofy to you, but that's what it is for me. And so I look forward to Friday night and being able to be with family and remember Kyle and allow God to bring some light into the darkness. So is it possible to live this way? Can you enter darkness and still live an ordinary life? Well, you can if you believe in a new normal. That even in death, life still goes on. The kids have to be fed, the dishes have to be done, the grass has to be mowed, you got to go to work or school, you got to pay the bills. All of that stuff still goes on in the midst of the darkness. And our choice is the key. We can run from the darkness or we can enter the darkness and face the pain of loss. We can indulge in self-pity or we can empathize with others and embrace their pain. We can run from sorrow and drown it in addictions, or we can learn to live with sorrow. We can nurse our wounds of having been cheated in life, or we can be grateful for what we do have. We can return evil for evil, or we can overcome evil with good. The choice is never easy, but it's ours to make. Thirdly, the pain can seem absolutely unbearable at times. Dr. Paul Brand wrote a book called Pain, the Gift Nobody Wants, and I've mentioned it a couple times. He worked with lepers, and the problem with lepers is that they don't feel no pain. And I found it interesting this week there was an article in the Daily News about a guy who has a rare condition that he can't feel pain. I don't know if you saw the article in the paper or not, but it just struck me as coincidental that it was this week that that article is in the paper when I'm talking about pain. Pain shows we have the capacity. Oh, wrong button. What do I do, Patrick? This black kind of thing up there. Wonder if I push it again. Okay. Whew. Thank you, Lord. Pain shows we have the capacity to feel, both physically and mentally, to actually feel things, and that's important in life. Pain and pleasure are two sides of the same coin. You can't have one without the other. And our truth is, our losses are so painful because of the enjoyment and the pleasure that those things or those people brought to us. So some of the ways we respond to loss and pain: denial. Oh, it's all a bad dream. It can't be. It's not really happening. Or somebody asks us how we're doing and say, oh, it's no big deal. I'm fine. I did some of that with Kyle's death. I wasn't totally honest with everybody who asked me. There's the old school response of big boys don't cry and just throw dirt on it and get back in the fight. And I grant you, there's times you have to do things like that when you're in the middle of pain, because like I said, life goes on. You know, you still got to do the dishes, you know, those kinds of things. But if in the process we're denying that the event ever occurred, then we're causing ourselves problems down the road. Sometimes we bargain with ourselves. We play the if-only game. If only I do this, then everything will be better. Or the other thing that sometimes we do, if I could just go back, I'd do this or that differently, and it would all be different. So we kind of negotiate with ourselves in terms of how much the pain is and how long the pain's going to bother us and be with us. And then there's indulgence. We try to drown our sorrows in something else, whether it's alcohol or drugs or sex or spending money or staying up all night and sleeping all day, or we go on binges because we can't face the pain. And honestly, again, trying to be honest with you, that was one of my biggest fears with Kyle's death, is that I would go back to drinking. And it really was a fear that I had. And there were times when I had to say no to myself because I knew that that wasn't going to solve my problem. And then sometimes we vent our anger. We seek revenge. We want to make someone pay, and we've been seeing that in Ferguson the last few days, a couple of weeks, with people just want God to punish someone. I hope they rot in hell. We even get angry at God and say, God, how could you ever do this to me? What did I do to deserve this? Like I say, I've learned that God has broad shoulders, and He doesn't get upset when I ask those kinds of questions. And these four things I've shared, denial and bargaining and indulgence and anger, they're not like stages you go through the Kubler's death process, but they are normal and they're powerful, and I would even say they're legitimate responses to a concept, to a loss. Because what they really do is send a signal that we're in desperate need in our lives. Viktor Frankl, who was a survivor of the Holocaust, writes, it's painful to talk, it's more painful to not talk. I can't tell you how many times I've used that in dealing with chaplaincy things with people who have suffered loss. It's painful to talk, but it's more painful to not talk. And so that's a response that we ought to use and getting through it. The pain is real. We need to face it. Fourthly, loss creates an aloneness like nothing else. Sitzer in his book writes this: loss creates a barren present, as if one were sailing on a vast sea of nothingness. Those who suffer loss live suspended between a past for which they long and a future for which they hope. They want to return to the harbor of the familiar past and recover what was lost: good health, happy relationships, a secure job. Or they want to sail on and discover a meaningful future that promises to bring them life again, a successful surgery, a second marriage, a better job. Instead, they find themselves living in a barren present that is empty of meaning. Memories are both good and bad. Memories are good because they help you remember the person or the thing or the event or whatever. So they're good. But memories are also bad because they help us remember. If I didn't have to remember that Kyle had died, life would be a lot easier for me. And so memories are the two-sided coin. They're both good and bad, and we have to be careful about putting them down one way or the other. Jesus said, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted, Matthew 5:4. Deep sorrow, in fact, causes us to prioritize our life, to look at life and ask serious questions about ourselves. What's really important? What really matters? Should I spend more time with family and friends, or should I work more? Should I show concern for others or bury myself in bitterness? Should I give to worthy causes or spend it all on me? Jesus said, what good is it a man to gain the world and lose his soul? We may never get over what we lost, but I tell you, by God's grace, we can live on through it. As a chaplain, I tell people there's no such thing as closure, and I really don't believe there is any such thing as closure anymore. It bothers me when people say, well, you'll have closure one day. No, you won't. You see, it's never really over, and that if closure means that you never think about it again, you never remember again, if that's what closure means, and that's what it means to me, then that's not going to happen. In time, the event will change its impact on our lives, but get over it, have closure? No. It becomes part of that new normal that I talk about. Sitzer writes, recovery is a misleading and empty expectation. We recover from broken limbs, not amputations. When the thing you love most is cut off from you, you don't recover from that quickly. Fifthly, loss leads to confusion of identity. We know ourselves based on relationship with people and things and circumstances and events. That's how we know ourselves. I used to be a police chaplain. I used to be married, but now I'm divorced. I used to be healthy, but now I have inoperable cancer. And so our very identity is linked with people and places and events and things that are around us. And all loss affects and impacts our identity. That's why sometimes you may get the new job, but you still long for the old job. I can't imagine, when I was a chaplain, I can't imagine me suddenly not being able to do that job. And maybe all of a sudden going to work in a bank somewheres. Now, it might be great that I have a job. That's a good thing, I suppose. But I know me. I would long to be back out there on the road again. And I talk to a lot of police officers who have retired, and they don't miss the job part, but they miss the camaraderie. They miss the relationship with other peers and things. And so the change that occurs, even if you go to something different, doesn't necessarily take away the sense of loss, because our identity is wrapped up in that so much. Amputees often experience what's called phantom pain. They think that their leg is still there. They think that it still hurts. They think that it's still working, and how come it's so painful? And, of course, there's nothing there to be painful, but you think about it that way because our identity is so much with that. The good thing is that having an identity crisis in the midst of pain can also lead to incorporating that loss into our lives, and that's what I'm trying to do right now with Kyle's death. I'm trying to incorporate his death into the rest of my life and take it along and carry it along with me and ask God, what does it mean and how can I use it and what's the purpose of all behind it? Our circumstances are given, but our responses are not. I can't change Kyle's death, but I can choose what my response to his death is going to be. And so I try to take charge of the things I can take charge of and let go of the things I can't take charge of. Now, again, I'm a work in process. I'm a hunk of clay on a potter's wheel that God's messing with. It's not easy, and it's not fun. There's times when God will take that clay and just punch the stuffings out of it to soften it up. It hurts. But I want God to change me. I want God to use Kyle's death to make me a better person in the long run. And I believe it can happen. It's all about focus. In Jesus' death, the disciples were scared and angry and afraid, and they ran and hid until they got their focus back on the real issues, and then they were at peace with one another. We need someone greater than ourselves to help us discover our new identity after suffering loss. And I tell you, that someone is God. I am so glad that God loves me, especially when I'm in pain, that he loves me. Viktor Frankl again says, the experiences of camp life, again, this is a prisoner of war camp in World War II in Germany. the experiences of camp life show that that man does have a choice of action. There are enough examples often of a heroic nature which prove that apathy can be overcome, irritability suppressed. Man can preserve a vestige of spiritual freedom, of independence of mind, even in such terrible conditions as psychic and physical stress. If there is meaning in life at all, then there must be meaning in suffering. Suffering is an irreducible part of life, even as fate and death. Without suffering and death, human life cannot be complete. Loss leads to confusion of our identity. And lastly, loss puts a sudden halt to business as usual. That night I got the call of Kyle's death. Whatever plans we had were gone. They changed. Business as usual didn't exist anymore. And often the end product of that business, losing our business as usual ability, is we regret things. We go into a regret mode. And if only I'd gone to the doctor sooner, if I'd tried harder, if I'd not drank so much that night. Or far too many of us camp out in that sea of regret and end up getting sicker in the process. The truth is, as I said, we can't change the situation, but we can let the situation change us. Too many of us have let the change sour us instead of change us. The Apostle Paul says, nothing can separate us from the love of God, nothing. We may not be delivered from the suffering, but we will be transformed. Again, I've suffered a lot of loss in my life. And as I look back on it, it wasn't the loss that made the difference. It's how I responded to it that made the difference. Some of you have heard my testimony of what happened to me in the church in Centralia when they ran me out on a rail. And I came very, very close to suicide. That's why I say I know the dark night of the soul. I've been there. I know what that looks like. I know what it feels like. But it was my response to the situation that kept me alive today. I couldn't get around the fact that Carmen and Jessica would be, our daughter Jessica, would be immeasurably hurt if I took my own life. But I was so mad, I was so upset with that church, I wanted to kill myself. And I've never told this part of this story. I'll tell it now. The way I was going to do, I had it all planned out, and that's one of the key signs to whether or not somebody's serious about it. Do they have a plan? I had a plan. I was going to go on Sunday morning to the front door of the church and shoot myself in the head, because I wanted them to come to the church and find my bloody body laying there at the entryway when they came to church that morning. That's how much hatred was in me at that point in time. But I'm so thankful that God didn't let me stay there. But I was there for a little bit. I'm so thankful he didn't let me stay there, because it's my response to the situation that's what really matters. And so when loss comes, it's our response that makes the difference. I want to take us quickly to two Bible stories that relate to everything I've been saying. First one is Job, and most of you know the story, and so I'll just kind of remind us a little bit. The story of Job begins with describing Job's virtue, his wealth, he's a rich guy, he's got a big family. They all live on this big plantation kind of thing together. He's got all sorts of cattle and sheep and oxen and stuff. He's got all the latest gadgets. He's got a faithful wife. He's a kind and generous man. He's a righteous man. The scriptures are clear that he loves God and he's faithful to God. And one would look at that story and say, if anybody deserves a good ride, it's Joseph. He's such a good guy. And then the scene changes and Satan comes to God and they have a conversation. He said, you know, God, why Job's such a goody-two-shoes? Because he's got it so easy. Make things a little tough on Job for a while. Then you'll see what kind of man Job really is. Well, God is the kind of guy who doesn't back down from a challenge. So he says, okay, have your way. You can do whatever you want, but you can't touch his head. You can't kill him in the process. Job's having a big family barbecue. I mean, it's a big shindig. The whole family's there. All of a sudden, one of his workers comes in and says, Job, all of your animals, all your cattle, all your sheep, all your stuff, they've all been killed or stolen, and they killed all your servants too, Job. Not long after that, another servant came rushing in, said, Job, all of your kids are dead. They've been killed. And your grandkids and your great-grandkids. And Job, they also destroyed all your houses. It's all gone. You got nothing, Job. It's toast. At that point, Job falls to his knees and he begins to weep and wail, and he begins to worship God in the process of that. His wife is the kicker to the whole thing. She finally gets to a point after Job has got boils all over his skin and he's so irritated by it and bothered by it that he actually takes broken pottery and scrapes the skin because it itches so much. And you can imagine what he looked like in that particular time. And his wife at that point has had it with the whole thing. And she says, Job, why don't you just curse God and die? I'm sick of looking at you. Just die. Job's response in Job 2:10 is this. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? It's important to note, I got to stop there for a minute because we read from the outside, not on the inside of the story. At this point, Job had no idea that Satan and God had had this conversation. He had no idea what was going on in the heavenlies at this point in his life, and yet he fell down and worshiped God. The next thing that happens is three of Job's buddies show up, guys by the name of Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. These friends have come to comfort Job, to make him feel better. So for 7 days, they sat together with him while he's scraping his skin with his pieces of pottery. And they're disgusted with his look. They can't hardly stand to look at him. But they sit there with him in 7 days and say nothing. And then all of a sudden, they decide, we need to help Job figure this out. And they go into a long diatribe, each of them, about why Job is in the fix he's in. And Job, there must be some evil in your life because otherwise God wouldn't do that. And I know, Job, that you look good and you shine pretty when we're in church and all that, and you give more to the church than anybody else, but Job, there's some evil there, and you've got some sin in your life, and that's why all this is happening to you. And this goes on for like 20-some chapters, this dialogue back and forth with these three guys and Job. And Job just keeps getting deeper and deeper in kind of a sorrowful kind of state, and they drive him down. They really helped him. Next thing that happens is another friend shows up, a guy by the name of Elihu. And Elihu is like a junior elder. Where's Patrick? He's an elder in training. He's younger than the other three guys, but he's had it up to here with all this stuff that they've been saying to Job. And so he steps up and he challenges them, and he essentially says to them, you may be older, but you don't know squat. Read the story yourself. And finally, Elihu turns to Job and he says, listen, God knows more than you know of what's going on here. And he turns to the other three guys and said, and you three guys, you better watch your P's and Q's or you're going to be in real trouble. You think you're in trouble now. You wait and see what happens. You keep going down this track. And finally, God enters the conversation. God and Job have a dialogue back with each other. It's four chapters. And God essentially asks Job a bunch of questions. He says, were you there when I created the heavens and the earth? Can you cast the stars in place? Have you ever given order to the morning or shown the dawn of its place? Do you send the lightning bolts on the way? Do they report to you? Does the hawk take flight by your wisdom? Does the eagle soar at your command? Talk about a wake-up call that Job got in that moment. As God kind of got in Job's face a little bit about all of this. And Job responds by repenting of his complaining and listening to his friends more than listening to God. And he says in Job 42:2, I know you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. And then God tells Job's buddies, you better ask him to pray for you, because if you don't, you're going to be in big trouble. And Job does, and everything turns out good. In fact, Job gets twice what he had before everything got destroyed. At first glance, it may seem like God is using Job as a pawn in a silly chess game with Satan, but it's really much bigger than that. You see, the key is, Job went from someone who spoke about God to someone who really knew God, and that reality came out of his suffering. Job learned that even in the apparent random acts of life, that God is there, always present, always fully aware. When you come to that kind of understanding of who God is, there's peace, even in the midst of the storm. Let's look at our other buddy, Joseph. You remember the story of Joseph? It's a story about a favored son, the youngest boy of Jacob, in Genesis 37 through 50. And dad buys Joseph a fancy coat. We know it as the coat of many colors. And we sang the song, or we've seen the play or the movie or whatever else. And the older brothers get jealous, and they seize upon an opportunity to sell Joseph, their brother, youngest brother, off to slave traders. And they can come back and they convince dad that Joseph, his most favorite son, has been killed by wild animals. And Joseph ends up in Egypt. He's working for Potiphar, one of the big shots in the Pharaoh's household. And he goes from slave to servant with all sorts of privileges. And Potiphar's wife becomes infatuated with him, and she tries to lure him into bed, and Joseph runs out. Potiphar finds out about it, ends up throwing Joseph in prison. He's there in prison. He ends up being the head trustee. If you know what a trustee is in jail or in prison, it's a guy who has special privileges, who kind of helps run the jail, and in many ways does run the jail. The trustees do in so many ways. Joseph interprets a couple of dreams for influential people, the baker and the candlestick maker, or whoever it was. And the long story short, ends up interpreting a dream for Pharaoh. And the dream that Joseph gives says, listen, there's going to be 7 years of prosperity and 7 years of famine, and you better store things up, or else the whole world's going to be in trouble. And ultimately, Joseph ends up being the number two man of all of Egypt. He's in charge of the whole operation of everything that goes on in Egypt. The only person more powerful than him is Pharaoh himself. But the rest of the story is that Joseph's family is suffering over in Israel, and the brothers come to Egypt to get food, and they have no idea that their baby brother is the man in charge now. So they go and they have interactions with each other, and Joseph finally reveals who he is to his brothers, and his brothers freak out. He thinks he's going to have their head on a platter, and Joseph ends up sending for his father and all the Israelites to come and live in Egypt with him, and all's well for several years there. What began as a tragedy ended up saving Joseph's family from sure starvation. Joseph suffered at the hands of his brothers, all the while God had a plan to rescue the Israelites. Joseph told his brothers, you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good. I would suggest that God had even a bigger plan than just saving Joseph's family when this whole thing went on. And somehow God had to get the nation of Israel to Egypt so they could be made slaves, so the guy by the name of Moses could come and lead the people out of Egypt into the promised land. Loss happens to everybody. And it's darkest before the light. And loss will challenge your identity in all sorts of ways. But have you heard the words, God's ways are not our ways? God's thoughts are not our? Isaiah 55:8. What can we learn from Job and Joseph and all the others who suffered loss along the way? Again, Sitzer says it so well for me. The story helps us to see our own tragedies can be a very bad chapter in a very good book. The terror of randomness is enveloped by the mysterious purposes of God. In the end, life turns out to be good, although the journey to get there may be circuitous and difficult. You can't read that little saying there, so I can't even until I get closer. What you spend years building, someone may try to destroy overnight. Build anyway. The bottom line to all of this is that when loss comes, the first thing we usually ask is, why me? Perhaps what we should learn to ask is, why not me? Why shouldn't God be able to use us to accomplish some great thing down the road that we haven't got a clue what's going on? But why shouldn't God be able to look down and say, Steve, I'm going to use Kyle's death in a way that you will not believe. And in fact, God's used Kyle's death already in many ways. There are people going to heaven today because of Kyle's death and the testimony that's been given. Young people. It's so exciting to have that happen. But I know it's not just about that either. It's about me and what God wants to do in me and what God wants to change in me and create in me. And who am I to look to God and say, I don't want to do it? And yet that's what we so often do in life. We bow our backs at the loss and tragedy, and we crawl into a pity party, and we point fingers every which way. But we never bother to ask God, what is it you want to teach me out of all this, God? What is it you have for me in all of this pain? Tell me, God. Show me. I would suggest that if we would start doing, and I mean we, me as much as anybody, if we would start doing that, the enemy would get less and less glory out of the stuff that happens around us all the time. So I don't know how you handle your loss. I don't know how you will handle your loss in the future. I just wanted to take an opportunity to drop some thoughts in your minds and your hearts about ways to process and handle the loss that comes. Because I will guarantee you, if you haven't had a loss for a while, there's one around the corner. It will come. Because I have to remind myself of that often. Kyle's death isn't the last loss I'm going to suffer. I know that. But I've learned along the way that all of this is unto something bigger than me. Does that mean I don't hurt, that I don't cry, that I don't get angry? Does it mean I do all that stuff. But as I work through it, I come back to the point of saying, why not me, God? Why not use me? It's okay. Just show me what you want to show me along the way. Teach me what you want to teach me. Make me, mold me, create in me what you have in store, regardless of what my plans are. So I would offer to you that there is loss, but it's not the end. All loss is unto something. I can endure all things through Christ who strengthens me. All things come to good for those who love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. Now, either those scriptures are lies or they're the truth. You have to decide for yourself. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Let's pray.